Hey there, and welcome to Creative License, where we dive into what makes creative people successful and immerse ourselves in that process. I'm your host, Alex Perlman. Sam Rosenthal has always been interested in gaming, but very few people take a childhood passion and turn it into a career. Athletes, singers, musicians, and the like have a pretty straightforward blueprint to doing that. Get really good at your craft. Sam had to do that same thing, but on top of that, have a compelling idea to turn into a game. Actually, he's had several, and from creating his debut project Where Cards Fall, a more traditional puzzle game which helped land him a spot on Forbes 30 Under 30, to founding his studio The Game Band, those ideas have worked and allowed him to dream up a new vision. That is Blazeball. Anything but conventional. In Sam's own words, it's an absurdist horror fantasy baseball game, and it's gone viral in its popularity, leading to celebration, but also presenting unique challenges that Sam and his team have encountered along the way. Now, full disclosure, Sam is my future brother-in-law, but his talent and accomplishments more than speak for themselves, as you'll soon find out. What started your love for video games? Let's start kind of like right towards the beginning and we can go from there.
Oh, man. I've been playing games forever. You know, when I was a little kid, I played Super Mario Bros. I think it was the first game that I ever played on my parents' Nintendo Entertainment System. And, you know, I grew up with Pokemon and with all sorts of, like, great Nintendo games. And I loved that when I was playing games, I felt like, it wasn't so much that they were telling me a story, it was that I got to be part of a story. I got to, you know, participate in something that felt bigger than me. And as a kid, like, what is more powerful than that? So, you know, as I got older, I kept that love, and I started to really seek out games that were trying to just to tell stories in different ways and to bring players into them in different ways. And I realized at some point, I was like, wow, like, there's so many different ways to go about this. And there's so many designers out there that are trying, like, radically different things. And, you know, while there's, you know, every art form, there's a lot of, you know, experimentation and people that try to push the limits. And this one, it felt like people hadn't even developed the language yet. You know, it was still in its infancy. And that was exciting to me. So I was like, oh, if I can learn how to do this stuff, then, you know, maybe I could be a pioneer too.
What were your first ideas? Like, when you first came up with that, were you just like, hey, this is interesting to me because I have a chance to pave my own way? Or did you have something in mind already that you're like, this is an issue that I'd like to correct, you know, right off the bat?
Honestly, at the beginning, it was just sheer interest in the space. And I had all sorts of game ideas, and most of them were really bad. you know, let's say I had, you know, in high school, like, it's really dumb juvenile ones. I remember making a Frogger game where you're like poop on the bathroom floor, like dodging. It was awful, 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 awful stuff. I'm not proud of it.
That sounds like a high school type of game.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. I was like, well, no one's played this type of game before I can be a pioneer. Yeah, you know, as I started to dive into this stuff more, I think the like real turning point for me was when I discovered Jenova Chen's game designer, who he came out of USC, which is where I went to college to study game design. And back when I was in high school, Flash was still a pretty big thing, and a lot of people were making games in Flash, and you would find all sorts of like weird and wild things there. This was before there was like a healthier independent games market, so you would typically go online and just kind of see what you could find.
There were some weird games out there, man.
Weird stuff.
I remember some really weird ones coming across in like high school and middle school.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And Jenova's was this game called Flow, and it was a Flash game where you're playing as this microscopic organism, and you were essentially like, You were growing as you ate things. I'm not describing this a very good way, but the thing that was special about Flow was it was incredibly atmospheric. It was very peaceful. It was a game that was like clearly not trying to be a power fantasy. It was trying to elicit a different type of emotion, and it was very clear, not just from playing it, but from the thesis paper that Genova had attached to it, because this was his thesis project in college, so I could read it and I could see exactly what he was trying to explore. He was really inspired by this principle in psychology, of flow theory, which is, can you get people in a state where their skill set matches the challenge at all times? And in flow, you could essentially like choose how to engage with how difficult you wanted the experience to be. So it's really cool to see somebody approach games from a way more like academic lens. And also, he wasn't making power fantasies. He wasn't making games about poop sliding on the floor. He was making something that was quite a bit more meaningful. And after I saw that, I started to think about like, okay, well, what could I do that's outside of the norm too?
Is that what made you want to go to USC in the first place?
It was what put it on the map for me, for sure. When I was in high school, I took all sorts of, computer classes and design classes, and spent a summer at Carnegie Mellon learning just more about game development. Yeah, USC was there were like by far the most established games program. At the time, there weren't that many, and when I discovered that they were promoting and encouraging people to design games like this that were really outside of the norm, that got me very excited. So when I applied to college, I really only applied to five schools. There were the five schools at the time that were not trade schools that had game design programs, because I wanted like a broader college experience too. And USC was my top choice, and I'm so glad that I was able to get in there.
It's not easy. I mean, and I think a lot of people know how good a game design school it is. Did you have to have an idea for a project at that point? Did you just kind of, did they go based off of potential? How did that work?
I mean, I couldn't really tell you exactly what they saw in me and why I got in, but
You didn't have
I
to
remember
submit a
the app.
game, did you?
You didn't have to submit a game, but there were various kind of creative work samples that were part of the application. I have no idea what it's like today, but back then at least, I remember writing up like a spec for a game that I would like to make. It was also like better than the high school ideas, but still a way away from the types of games that I ended up making. And I remember I also included, I had been learning a lot about like 3D modeling at the time, so I included some 3D models that I had created to show them that I had an understanding at least of some of the fundamentals of the technology too.
I think about it all the time, though. Like, what did Syracuse see in me? What could they have
Yeah.
possibly seen? Because I think back to like those times, and like, I had nothing. Like, I didn't have that much experience. Certainly didn't have a good tape. Thankfully, you didn't have to submit any type of your work. I don't know. I guess we got lucky in some ways, and then or they're very, very good at talent development. That might be it too, right?
Who knows? Who knows? But it's all about just getting over that line, and then then it opens the doors for you, and you can figure out how you want to walk through.
Well, that led to your first game, right? Where Cards Fall. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know it was chosen by Apple to jumpstart Apple Arcade. Your sister was very quick to point out that she is the only member of the Rosenfall family that's ever
That
finished that
is
game.
true.
How did the creation process go for that?
Yeah, it was I mean honestly like a decade long story. So I started prototyping games around building houses of cards my freshman year at USC. And where that came from was USC really preached starting with like an emotional core. Like what type of feeling do you want your game to elicit before you start to figure out like I'm going to make a sports game or I'm going to make a auto chess game or something like that. So with Where Cards Fall, I was thinking a lot about a Radiohead song that I loved, the song House of Cards. And that song is, I thought it was a really like beautiful just expression of letting something fall apart in your life and finding a way to build something new out of it. And I was thinking about like how this is such an age-old idiom. People use that House of Cards metaphor for so many different things. But it's also like the visualization of it is it's a bunch of game pieces, right? Like it's a bunch of cards that are stacked together and fall apart. And that could be a really interesting way to express life, in a way that makes sense as a video game. I really wanted Where Cards Fall at the beginning to be to be a systemic game. What I mean by that is a lot of games focus on how different systems interlock and intersect. If you think about a game like Civilization, it's a lot about building a civilization from the ground up, and thinking about the economy, thinking about territory and things like that. The Sims does a lot of people management there, and I was trying to figure out how to make this game with cars do that, but I was a beginning game designer and I couldn't figure it out. But I was also working an internship at Disney while I was in college, and I worked on a game there called Where's My Water, which is a puzzle game on iPhone. And I learned a lot about puzzle design. And what I found was that, I'm pretty confident that I could make this game as a puzzle game. And some other members of my team had also were interested in the idea and showed me some ways that we could do it. So, it took the 4 years at USC and working with a great team of students that were helping to kind of find what its core really was going to be. And it ended up being this coming of age story that was told through solving these little individual puzzles of life and having the euphoria of remembering something lead you into the next. We came out of USC with that structure, with that idea, with a game that was compelling, but dramatically unfinished and had a long way to go. So I went and I worked in the games industry for several years, and I kept this one alive on the side. And I looked for funding for it for a good while, struggled for a good while to find funding, and eventually was able to. And, it was a small amount of money at the beginning, but it was enough to start a company and get this thing off the ground. All the Apple stuff came much later, but
right.
I was glad that I kept going with that project.
Yeah, what did you learn from that experience? It must have been so eye-opening in so many different ways.
Yeah, there's so much. I think when I think back to where Wetware Cardswell really started to come together in my final year at USC, USC kind of throws you into the deep end in a good way, where you got a chance to lead a team during your senior year, and I got to work with all these really talented students and struggle to figure out what we were making and work with all these amazing different disciplines that saw the game from a different light. An engineer is going to come in with a different perspective than an artist. And
is this a team that was really fun. Of underclassmen that you get to work with?
It was
that
a
how
mixture.
They set
it
up,
it was
or
undergrads and grad students. Yeah, kind of mixed together, and we were all just trying to turn this game into something. And I really loved how intensely collaborative it felt. And every game development project that I've ever been part of since then has felt intensely collaborative. I think this is one of the most collaborative art forms that you can imagine. I think there's something to be said for clear direction and for vision holders and such, but at the same time, everyone is bringing in their own sensibilities and are able to shape the project in their own way. It's one of the reasons I named my company the Game Band, is because I think music has this in common, where you have a lot of people that are playing different instruments, bringing a different part of the sound together, but at the end of the day, you're creating one cohesive sound, and people think of it as one unit, one band.
And you've kind of continued that, I guess, throughout your entire experience. When you formed the Game Band, did you have people in mind that you wanted? Did you meet people that way? How did that whole experience come about?
Yeah, the first people that joined the company were former students that I worked with at USC. And I was really grateful that they continued to be passionate enough about the project and liked working with me enough to want to do this full time. But then some of the other early in people came from companies that I worked at. So Corey, who's our 3D artist at the Game Band, he and I worked together on a game called What Remains of Edith Finch at a company called Giant Sparrow. And when that project wrapped, he came in and joined me at the company. He's been here ever since. There's other people at Giant Sparrow that later joined the Game Band too. Friends of mine from college that eventually wanted to come on board as well. And then I met all sorts of great people throughout my time in the industry that I was able to bring on. And then, of course, at some point, we started to actually do a more formal hiring process and open the doors to candidates from all over.
All right, so I'm going to give you a few more accolades here, like we talked about. You were named Forbes 30 Under 30 in late 2019, which I'm sure was such a cool personal honor and just a verification of what you'd been able to do and how much of a visionary you are in the industry. But then again, when you have the game band and you have a company, doesn't that give some legitimacy at the same time? And does that open up some doors for you guys?
Yeah. It was an amazing honor, and certainly not something that I ever expected. I think like the thing that has it's helped a lot in two very distinct ways. One was that I got to meet a lot of other really interesting people with fascinating businesses that are both in and outside of the games industry, and I was really grateful to get on that list just to be exposed to all of that, and have made some great friends through there as well. The other part is, you know, those types of awards and accolades, they certainly matter, especially when you go out to pitch what you're making and, you know, to raise money or to get people to fund your ideas. You know, that stuff I think is very helpful there too. At the end of the day, like the greatest reward for us is still always the response from our players. You know, the industry accolades are amazing, of course, and it's wonderful to get good reviews and things like that, but what we really love seeing is when people write us that play the games and say like, hey, this was what the game meant to me, or by creating artwork around the game or music, or, you know, if it inspired them and to do something in their own life that was outside of just playing the game, then you know, that's the biggest reward of all.
Let's jump into your latest venture because we kind of buried the lead. This is what you guys are up to right now. And we can talk more about running a company a little bit later. We'll definitely dive into that, but that's creative, obviously different in its own way. But your latest venture is Blazeball, which has really taken off. Now it's the main focus. To someone who has never heard of it, not in the gaming space, give us a description. I know it's not an easy task, but but do your best.
You know, I've been asked this so many times now, and I still struggle. But Blazeball is an absurdist horror fantasy baseball game. So this is a game that allows you to be a fan of a fake baseball team that plays simulated baseball games, and you bet on the games with fake money, and you cash in your earnings with all the other fans to vote to make changes to the league. So you can vote to change the rules, you can vote to change the story, and as everybody bands together and starts to organize to change things, you start to realize that there's a lot more sinister things happening beneath the surface here. So the baseball in some ways is a front for this much weirder and funnier kind of horror narrative that's kind of simmering beneath the surface of it.
But how exactly does it, like, what are you doing if you're playing the game, so to speak? I know you're not, that's the thing, you're not really playing, right? It's very different than picking up a controller on an Xbox or a PlayStation, like going to work as the Broncos in Madden. What's the intrigue?
Yeah, it's certainly not like an MLB The Show type of experience. So what you're actually doing in a moment-to-moment basis is you're betting on the games with that fake currency. And then you know, the loop, so games are, we always talk about games in forms of loops. Like what's the thing that you're constantly doing over and over again that changes a little bit? And with baseball, it's you're betting, you're using your rewards to get upgrades and votes, and then you're voting to change things. But that's not really where the appeal lies. Where the appeal is the community side to the game. So because there's, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people playing this game at once, no individual person can enact dramatic change. You have to organize with the other people that are playing the game to get what you want. So if you are a fan of the Baltimore Crabs, as I am, one of our baseball teams, and you want to help them win a championship, well, you know, your votes are just your votes. You're going to need to start a social media campaign or so, or talk to the other fans to get enough support to get what you want actually done. And that's what we see. You know, our fans have organized around the game. We have this Discord server where they talk to each other and commune and watch the games together. A lot of it has happened on Twitter and social media. So it becomes this more like kind of mass community event. And the game is sort of the entry point into all of that.
You talk about Discord, which obviously has been very important for the gaming industry as itself. You guys are getting ready as we record this to relaunch a new season, kind of a reboot as opposed to maybe an evolution is what I've kind of heard from you and others. Is there any interest in taking that in-house and making your own kind of Discord server and having everything be like a one-stop shop in some ways?
Yeah, we're certainly bringing some aspects of the communal experience into the core, but in a way that is way more specific to what this type of game actually is. You know, the advantage of doing something like Discord at the beginning is it's already got a user base, and it's easy to get people to like just jump into and check it out. Well, to an extent, and you know, it's we don't have to build it. It's a thing that already exists, but and what we found was that, you know, we got a lot of people to sign up for the game, and only a small portion of them joined our Discord. But our Discord was where the community kind of lived, and it was where the people became super fans. We're like, okay, like we should take that spirit and bring that into the game. But, you know, if we went and built Discord and just attached it to the game, that's way out of scope for what we're doing, and honestly not great, because the way the Discord is designed isn't really meant to be like a companion to games like this. So we went, okay, yeah. Like what's the better version of that for Blazefall? You know, what aspects of it do we really like that we would want to bring into this experience and get people interacting with each other in a way that is more tied towards the game?
Where did it come from? The whole idea. This is something that I've never even thought you would see, you know, for it to be such a non-traditional type format and for you to be playing video games almost, but not playing video games. How in the world did you guys come up with this idea?
Yeah, so it came from a few different places. During the pandemic, and the game was made like early in the pandemic, and you know, we were all isolated, all just sitting at home. And one of the main like inspirations for me with the game band has been trying to broaden the audience for games. You know, but if we go back to high school real quickly, like at that point where I was playing Flow and all of that, most of my friends were already starting to were not interested in games or like dropping them. And you know, I know Hannah is the only person that's beaten Work Hard, Spoil the Family, but I mean, it shows like most people in my family don't really like or play video games too. So right. I've always been like the evangelist trying to get more people into the fold.
And the cult of games.
Exactly. Yeah. And during the pandemic, you know, most of my friends from college, that I have a really close group of friends from college, none of them really play video games, but they wanted to play these like browser-based versions of board games and card games like over Zoom. And I thought that was really interesting because they were down to play something that was A, familiar to them, and B, on a web browser, so we didn't have to think about like, oh, do you have a Nintendo Switch or are you on Steam or any of that. It's just, yeah, we just open up a browser tab and join it. But it was also kind of a pain to like organize all those Zoom calls. So I was like, okay, is there a way that we can do this at scale where we have a game that's constantly running, where a mass amount of people could all jump in and join in and play and bring people together? And that was the design challenge. So the first thing that I pitched the team was, what if we made a horse racing game where you're betting on these simulated horse races and getting really invested in the outcomes, and a mass amount of people can kind of steer the direction. So it was like the fundamentals of Blazefall, but not with a theme. And Joel, who's our lead game designer, who I've been making games with for a really long time, we met at USC, he was like, well, that's cool, Sam. The mechanics are interesting, but horse racing, like none of us are into horse racing, like
yeah,
can we do
sure.
better than that? Joel and I are big Dodgers fans. We spent a lot of time in LA going to Dodger games together. I remember there was a playoff game where the Dodgers started to lose and we started to riff and be like, what if, you know, we're already down, like let's just mess around, like what would make this more interesting for us? Well, what if the players were carrying jugs of water on their heads, or what if like the rules were different? And you know, we just started to riff and we went back to that like ludicrous conversation. We're like, okay, well, maybe there's actually something there. Like maybe that's actually a fun element to bring into the video game.
And so you came up with, I mean, the ideas are endless. It's remarkable to me that you guys are able to even brainstorm something like a player being incinerated in mid-game. You had a secret base, right, that players could like hide out on, and then they reappear later in the game. And it's not like if, you know, the Yankees are playing the Red Sox and the Yankees score two runs on a single, you can't take that away. They're going to have at least two at the end of the game. That's not how baseball works.
Not
you
so.
Have unruns so the runs can come off the board. I mean, did it like just start in terms of your brainstorm and then just go off the rails?
Yeah, you know, I will credit Stephen Bell, who's he's a narrative game designer here at the company, also someone I've worked with for a long time. He was the one that brought a lot of the wildness and the weirdness into baseball at the beginning. So when Joel and I got a version of the game, very like rudimentary version of the game up and running so that we could test it, we always like play test a lot of whenever we have an idea, we have to prove that it's going to be fun. So we bring in some, you know, outsiders and such and start to try it out with them. And we had Steven trying the game out really early, and his imagination just went wild. He was like, well, what if can there be something like the Naked Gun where like the umpires are assassins and they can kill players? And we're like, okay, that wasn't where we were naturally going, but yeah, why not? And we just kind of kept saying yes to like all of these wild ideas and finding room for them in the game. And that led to focusing the tone and the theme a lot more on this kind of absurd horror element. You know, a lot of it's just also the reflection of like the madness of, you know, we're all feeling in the pandemic too.
Sure, of course.
Of the world at the time. But yeah, you know, there's so much that you can do with iterating and tweaking a game that is like very commonly understood. It's one of my very favorite things about sports is, yeah, they're like the longest game design iterations. You get to see like every year there's like one or two rule changes and they're hotly contested and you can see how they affect things. Baseball is just speeding that up to a ridiculous, you know, speed and introducing ones that would never, ever fly. And it's fun. You get to see how they work for a week and then we take them away and try something else.
Right. We didn't even mention that the season is only a week long.
That's right.
Which is
a new champion every single week.
And it's so different too. You're right. You can put that in and then just see how it works. And then the next week, maybe tweak it a little bit. And you've got, well, you guys have obviously a lot of players and a lot of followers at this point and a lot of people from all different backgrounds, but you have some really tech savvy fans as well, I would imagine, that are in this space. So how do you make sure, and I know this happened kind of towards the beginning, right? How do you make sure that they don't alter the game in some way that is completely different than what you as the company that owns it, that runs it, that is changing it and is in control of it, that you want?
We ran into some problems early on, which you might be alluding to, where we had this mechanic in the game where you could get peanuts, and we had this whole like mystery that was planned out with what the peanuts actually do. And some fans figured out in like hour three of us introducing this that if they changed something, we had left some of our API endpoints open, and they touched them and found a way to give themselves infinite peanuts, and that screwed up everything. So I think we in the moment kind of found a philosophy to baseball, which is that the bugs are part of the story. You know, the game was crashing, we weren't able to keep it up, so our solution was to throw a massive peanut on the website and yell at the players. And that massive peanut became the antagonist, naturally, of our first storyline of baseball. We've had other elements of this, not necessarily driven by the fans, but our own technical mishap. There was a grand slam that resulted in a game going back in time, and that was something that, you know, we could have just like paused it and tried to rejigger things, but the fans named it the Grand Un Slam, and we just made that part of the story. So, you know, we just run with these things, and we are buttoning things up a little bit more as we gear towards our next release, so that, you know, we can at the very least like get the ideas that we have off the ground and to put them in, but we are leaving plenty of room. We're being, I should say, more specific about where we want the fan involvement to be, for both the health and sanity of our team and for the story to continue in a way that is a little bit more structured.
Has the response that this overwhelmingly positive response, and all different people from around the world so invested in these fake teams, you know, Baltimore Crabs, Seattle Garages, which should be a name for a team in Seattle. Like screw the Mariners, the Garages. that kicks way more ass, I think. Are you shocked at all by the response, and that so many people are so interested and love your game so much?
Definitely. This was a side project for us. It was an experiment. We were having a great time with it internally, but whenever you release a game, it's terrifying. Like the night before we launched Blazeball, I was like, yeah, maybe we should just scrap this whole thing, because this is kind of ridiculous and people might think it's so stupid and might destroy any credibility that we gain from where cards fall.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, we never expected it to take off the way that it did. I think we first got a taste for it when we started the fan art came in. We're like, whoa, people are making fan art out of these like silly player names. And then that exploded. And then suddenly there was a band around the Seattle Garages that was making music and people were writing stories. And it was completely overwhelming, so far beyond anything that we ever could have expected for this game.
How, when you look at, you know, the response and people love it so much the way that it is, but obviously you have to evolve the game. You have to make sure that it stays relevant. How do you do that in its next iteration and make sure that you don't have a change in there that people are really upset about and might even cause some negative backlash?
Yeah. So for the next version of the game, we have a number of goals for it. So first off, like it's going to be on mobile for the first time. You know, we only have been on web browsers before. Yeah. So it's launching on iOS and Android, and the web is still going to be there too. So you can play it however you'd like. It's a big deal for us for a lot of reasons. One is people are out and about more today, and we want to give them a way to actually take the game with them and interface with it in a way that's a little less all-consuming. You know, when you're on a mobile device, you can get notifications about how your team is doing and how your bets paid off and things like that, which is a nice, more passive way of playing the game than what the web version demanded before. You know, another thing that we found was that because this game is live, a lot of fans would jump in, say like week three or four, and be like, well, what happened? And it was challenging for them to catch up. They would have to go on YouTube and find fan-made videos or ask people in the Discord and such. So we are playing with a lot of different ways to solve that problem and to make it feel like when you jump in to Blazeball, you actually don't need to read a book to understand what's going on here. You can jump right in and start having fun. Alongside of that, you know, Blazeball started off in this, we didn't have like a tutorial or anything. You kind of had to jump in and figure it out. And there was some joy to, for the first fans to like come in and like find this weird, interesting thing and ask other people how it was working. But at some point that has its limits. And, you know, when you're trying to reach more and more people, you can't expect everyone to take the time to, you know, really engage with it when it has all these rough edges. We've smoothed a lot of that out, made it easier for first time players to come into. But yeah, at the same time, like, you know, we also know that this is not the very first season of Blazeball where we are all banding together to open the Forbidden Book without any idea what this experience is going to be. People have an idea of what Blazeball is now. So that means that the styles of story that we tell are different, and the way that we surprise our players has to change with their expectations.
I think that's interesting because I can relate to that certainly in terms of different sports you call. There are some diehard fans of gymnastics, but there are also fans that are tuning in because it's an Olympic year, or they know that, you know, Suni Lee, the reigning all-around gold medalist in the Olympics, is going to be competing for Auburn. So how do you draw that line, right, of not dumbing it down so much for the expert fan or the one that's been involved with it the entire time that, you know, that they could be, so to speak, and then the person that's tuning in for the first time?
Yeah, it's a challenge. You know, we're not just like just adding features that make it simpler. We also are improving the core game experience too. So for longtime fans, they're going to come back to a dramatically improved Blazeball simulation. I won't go too deep into what that means, but we spent time to completely rebuild the simulation that powers baseball to make it more interesting and to create more, better, more interesting game outcomes without us having to, it's fun to constantly change the rules, but that can't be the crutch. Like, we have to actually have like a really cool, fun game to watch under the surface of all of that. So you're going to see some really big improvements there too. I think giving fans ways to work with each other in a more natural way will help a lot as well, because that removes some of the friction, of just like joining communities and things like that in baseball. And then we also, the game has a very different style of storytelling this time around that I think is going to surprise all fans.
Looking forward to returning. It.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And I think it goes back to the point, that you talked about at the very beginning about what emotion do you want someone to feel while they're playing it. The interesting thing to me is that it's almost like everybody is feeling that emotion together, whatever that is, yeah. Right? It's whatever they want. It's not like if you're going in and playing GoldenEye and the emotion you feel is just like just scared to death that someone's going to come out from around the corner and shoot you. It's kind of like everybody banding together, whether or not a team is losing or winning or anything in between.
Yeah, it's that collective emotional outpouring that you get from sports. And I think there's something so incredibly powerful about that. And it's not something that games usually give you. You're usually in a game, you're playing and experiencing a story by yourself. Or you are competing with 20 or so other players. But the idea of like all experiencing the repercussions of your choices together at the same time, that is very new and it's very powerful. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of our fans have latched onto.
All right, so we've talked a lot about your newest venture. Of course, we know you're the Game Band's creative director, but you're also the CEO. And obviously, that has its own responsibilities. It's a completely separate undertaking. What has it been like for you? How have you learned how to run a company?
Yeah, I will say that I'm still learning. Every day is a new set of challenges. When you go out to make a video game, like, because it's a collective art form, you sort of have to also figure out if you want to start a new game, you're likely also going to be thinking about how am I going to start a company too.
True.
And with the Game Band, like, we have had a very unusual history, and I think a lot of probably the biggest takeaway is to never get too attached to one long-term vision, because this industry moves fast and it changes quickly and you have to be ready to adapt. For the first several years of the Game Band, we were a publisher-funded company, meaning, we were paid to develop a game that was going to be released on a subscription service and then later on a more traditional digital storefronts. Now we are a venture-backed studio, and that has a different set of expectations, and it made more sense for the style of game that we are now making, because this is not a game that is something that we can easily sell for $20. We don't want to sell it for $20. We want it to be free and we want it to grow and we want it to change with the company and to be able to build on top of that too. So the way that you fundraise changes and the way that you hire changes, because we're now looking for a different set of talent than we were looking for when we were building games like Where Cards Fall. But I think the thing that stays the same is, we've spent a lot of time working on our studio culture, on our values, and making games that are really unique and joyful and can bring a lot of different types of people into the fold. And there's a nice through line between all of the different changes that we've had at the company there. And I think that's been a huge advantage for us, as we hire people from all different types of industries, but they come into a studio culture that is pretty well defined and works together really well and values the employees. We fight against a lot of the things that you see in the games industry that don't work so well at like larger companies and such.
You talked about hiring different types of people based on, publisher-based or venture-based. What are those types of different people that you're looking for or that you've already hired?
Yeah, I should say, let me clarify that a little bit, because it's not so much that the funding model changes the types of people. It's more that we changed our funding model because we changed the type of company that we are and the types of games that we're making. And the types of games that we're making now demand a different set of talent. So Where Cards Fall was a single player 3D game made in Unity, which is one of the most popular game engines out there. So we were hiring a lot of people that had proficiency in that tool set. But Blazeball was launched in web browsers, and it was built on web and app frameworks. So that meant that we were not even using the tools that most games are made in. We were doing something very different. And when we go and hire talent now, we're looking for people with an expertise in those frameworks, both like from a technical standpoint, but then also like designers that are used to designing great websites and apps and things like that, which means that we like to look to the tech industry. And we bring in a lot of people that haven't actually worked on games before, but have always wanted to and have a passion for this stuff, but they never had the matching skill set. Here they do. So it's an advantage for us, with hiring, and it also lets us widen the perspectives of the company, which is really important. That was also true of Where Cards Fall. Even though we were making a game in a more traditional, framework, we hired a lot of people from like visual effects, from commercials, from film production, to really try to reach an audience that was beyond the typical audience for video games.
Right. That makes sense. And certainly, graphically it's a beautiful game, so I'm sure that that brings some people in, and I would imagine that made an impact, for sure. Are you looking at, I mean, there's obviously going to be a time after Blazeball, or at least something that comes after Blazeball. Maybe Blazeball still exists, but something else might come along. Will it be similar? Are you guys done with the traditional, user-based experience, or are you trying to develop something else, like in the Blazeball ilk as well?
Yeah, we're certainly building on top of what we've learned from with Blazeball. Even if you look at the shape of the team, like because we've hired so many people with this particular set of expertise, we don't want to have to be constantly shifting the team. We want to build on our success and all the things that we've learned. But we also want to be able to reinvent and to surprise. Like that has always been one of the core philosophies of the studio is to not just repeat ourselves and to do things that push boundaries and change things. I've always been really drawn to platforms that are not traditional game platforms because I've always felt like there are so many more people that could fall in love with games and would if they were only in places that they would access. Like my mom doesn't know what Steam is, and a lot of other game companies around our size like are squarely focused on Steam, and like it's a great platform, there's a lot of great games on it, but it's kind of preaching to the choir. And we're interested in going beyond that. So that means that we want to continue to invest in the web and into mobile, and it doesn't break or stop us from doing more traditional game platforms, but it's not going to be our focus. We're going to focus on places where we feel like we have a broader audience. With different types of people that wouldn't normally feel welcome in games.
I think the biggest question, though, that is probably coming to everybody's mind is, it's amazing. It's a great game. People love it. At the end of the day, how do you make money from it?
Yeah, so our next version of Blazeball is going to have some things for people to buy for really for the first time, at least integrated into the game. We think we've, I'm not going to talk too specifically about it, but we've got something that I think people are going to really like that is well within the spirit of what we've seen people value around the game. We had a Patreon at one point where people were spending money to really just support us. We saw fans selling all sorts of merchandise around the game. These are all avenues that are compelling and interesting. We don't want to step on any toes for what the fans are already doing. We want to do something that is more specific to what we can bring to the table, and hopefully delight them and improve their play experience in some ways. We're not going to ask them to spend money on anything that they need to play the game. The game's going to stay free. It's more of here's a way to have a little bonus or something that you can help remember your experience playing the game with.
Let's end on this note. Let's kind of bring it out a little bit, broad picture, bring out the scope. What is some advice that you have to just any creative out there? It doesn't have to be video game designer, anybody that wants to create something. What would you say?
Ooh, let's see. I think that oftentimes when I talk to like younger creatives or people trying to kind of get their start, I see a lot of fear, you know, a lot of like, I don't know if this idea is going to work, or I don't know if this is practical or so. And my advice is to create an environment where you feel free to explore and feel free to test and to try things without so much of a fear of failure. Because a lot of your ideas aren't going to work, but if you don't try them, you're never going to find the one that nobody has thought of before that really could. I think that a lot of our big successes, both as a company and then even before, you know, as students and such, came from having the space to feel like we're going to throw this out there. We're going to try something. If it hits, amazing. If it doesn't, on to the next thing. And I would really try to create that environment for yourself. And then also bring on collaborators early. You know, I think like if you can have a place where you can run your work by friends and workshop things with them together, you'll find ideas that you never would have had, because that's what happens when you start sharing your work with other people. And you might end up with something that you didn't expect in a really good way.
Well, you certainly did, Sam. Thank you so much for the time. This was so enlightening and so much fun. Great to learn about Blazeball and more about the Game Band, and hope everybody checks it out.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Creative License is created, hosted, podcasted, obviously. Let's try that again. Creative License is created, hosted, produced, and edited by Alex Perlman, with inspiration and guidance from Hannah Rosenthal. Graphic design by Carrie Lindgren. Our thanks once again to Sam Rosenthal for lending his insight and experiences this week. Follow Sam on Twitter at Sam Rosenthal, or head to the Game Band's website, thegameband.com. You can find Creative License on Twitter at CLPod, and follow me on both Twitter and Instagram at AR Perlman. Shoot me a DM. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.